We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores, the games every day.
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Pete, joined by Darius and Mike. And if you've been tuned out from basketball for a couple months because the Lakers stunk this year and it wasn't particularly fun to watch basketball, but you're somehow listening to the pod, first of all, thank you. Secondly, I completely understand. And thirdly, try to adopt a team or a player or something. There's some really great basketball being played right now. We had a trio of game fives tonight that we're going to try to hit each game in each segment. And we're going to start with Miami and Atlanta. Miami ended up closing out Atlanta despite the best efforts of DeAndre Hunter, who was phenomenal down the stretch, but they couldn't quite do it. And just the fact that it was DeAndre Hunter as their go-to guy down the stretch, I want to start through that Lakers lens that we all always try to call back to. Trae Young, after a pretty electric playoff performance in last season's playoffs, Miami locked him up in the first round. And to the point, again, where with Atlanta's life on the line, they were going to DeAndre Hunter, the big wing who could get his own shot a little bit because Trae could not. And that was something that I noticed throughout this series. The Miami plays a very high caliber of defense, D. And when you're able to switch up your looks and put size on those smaller guards, it makes life difficult on them. Life in the playoffs can be very tough. One element that I was thinking while watching Trae too is that he's not the greatest athlete, which I think is another kind of factor, because we're going to talk about Ja a little bit later, who struggled, but then played well and had a game winner tonight. So let's harken back to that small guard conversation. I'd love to hear your perspective on, now that we have a few playoff games to look at that.
When you look at a small guard, I tend to always go back to like, well, what is the defense capable of doing? Right? Because you could be a small guard, but if the defense can't switch, and if the defense has to play in a drop because their big isn't very mobile, what are the different things that your defense can do? And that's where I think Miami, I'm going to shift right back to Miami again, because they're going to give a lot of guards a lot of problems, right? But they're especially going to give a smaller guard like Trae issues. I also think, too, that this plays into some of Trae's weaknesses as a player in general. He is such a creative passer, but his passing windows, you can disrupt his passing windows in ways that even, Trae's even smaller than Steph, right? And so Steph has all of these nifty ways that he gets passes off, but he's also playing with a guy who operates in the short role in Draymond that goes to spots on the floor where they have a real synergy, where it's just like, okay, well, this is where you're going to be open. So that's where I'm going to throw the ball. And Trae doesn't really have a partner like that. So he has to back dribble a lot and then jump and try to throw skip passes, or like there's no real pocket outlet for him that's going to create the types of dynamic 4-on-3s that really get your offense going. And so when I look at a guy like Trey, showing high on him or trapping him or getting high hands with bigger defenders and then being able to at the last minute bail out of that and switch and have a guy like Bam up on you is, and then stay with you in a way that is just like, okay, well, there's 6 seconds left on the shot clock. What am I going to do now with a dude who's on me and I'm 25 feet from the basket? Those sorts of things just disrupt your entire flow. And Mike, we've seen the Lakers when they've been at their best with LeBron and Anthony Davis do that a bunch to smaller guards, right? Or even guards who aren't necessarily as small as Trey, but they've done it to like Dame, and they did it to Jamal Murray, and they've done it to even players like Donovan Mitchell or even James Harden at times. And Steph too. Yes.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me that a small guard could be, that this can happen to a small guard, but I think it speaks more to Miami to a certain extent than it does necessarily just to Trey. Like, this is something that you can do against Trey, but New York tried to do some of this stuff last year, Pete, and they had no chance against him. And it's because you need more ingredients than just like, oh, a guy at the point of attack and a big guy who can do some things on a switch.
The Trey Young case is pretty interesting, and I think that it's also simple in the fact that, so this series to me has been the least interesting of the first rounds, because the way that Miami plays defense to me, Atlanta just doesn't have enough to deal with that game plan that's so focused on Trae Young. And then, you know, sure, tonight DeAndre Henry went off, but for the most part, it's just they can control that. Like Atlanta, they're playing, Capella played this game. He didn't play before that, but Onyeka Okongwu was playing at center. And then Collins has kind of been banged up, but been in and out. So that's your 4-5. You know, there's no Anthony Davis in there, like offensively. There's no like real threat to a defense. And then in the backcourt, Herter, nice player, but he's not going to scare you a ton. And off the bench, you know, Wright and Gallinari, Bogdanovich I like as a player too, but it's just, it's not enough to beat a really good playoff defense like Miami. And so I mean, that's, go ahead, Pete.
Sorry, I mean, Atlanta was second in the NBA in offense this season. They got a lot of guys that can score. Bogdanovich didn't play tonight, but even guys like Collins. Like, Collins is a scorer. He's not a go-to guy, but they've got weapons at a variety of different positions, right? It's not just Trey that they're weaker on the defensive end, but I think that, I don't know. I think that locking them up.
They don't have a lot of primary weapons. John Collins has averaged 9.4 points this series.
Right. But part of that is, one, he's come back from an injury, but two, like, Miami's defense is good. But I don't know. I just, like, Atlanta was the second best offense in the league this year. They were a conference finalist last season. Miami didn't have Jimmy or Kyle Lowry in this game.
But which speaks to Atlanta to me. So last year, so they beat the Knicks, who were clearly fraudulent last year, right? We've been over that a little bit, but they took advantage of year one Tibbs and played harder than a lot of teams because Tibbs demanded it. And then they also, there were no home crowds in that. So that made a big difference to have the coach that were kind of putting them over the top. And so then the next round was Philly. And Philly, I think we've sort of seen a lot of the warts of Philly. That was, of course, the Ben Simmons series. And, you know, Embiid not stepping up, but not a ton. Then they get to Milwaukee, who doesn't have Giannis for the bulk of that series. So it was like, it was a very sort of unique run in the way that, like, Portland was a conference finalist a couple of years ago, right? But ended up getting smashed by Golden State. And I don't believe in Atlanta, I guess, is the point.
I'm not arguing that Atlanta is like a great team or anything, but they won 14 out of their last 19 games. I believe they had the best home record in the NBA in the second half of the season. They won 20 out of their last 23 at home. They were a team that made the conference finals, certainly under unusual circumstances. I agree that they were not a conference finalist caliber team in most seasons, but they were a good team.
Well, they did finish eighth, though, Pete, right? Like, they were four games above 500 this year. They were pretty healthy.
But if you look at their second half of the season compared to the first half of the season, I think that there's we've talked about the bubble tax. I think that there's been a less severe one for this year. Like seeing all these guys just across the league get hurt so far during these playoffs, like having guys like Jimmy and Kyle Lowry, you know, Middleton, Booker, we've had a few other guys over the last few days that, you know, that have missed games. And I think that there's a slightly less severe version of the bubble tax this year, that Atlanta was a team that did not start particularly well, but they have talent, particularly on the offensive end, to where, I don't know, I regard them as a better team than your normal eighth seed.
But so they're second in offense, right? But that's partly because they're 26th in defense. You know, like, so if you're, it's a little bit, so Washington was up there in pace and offensive rating.
I think that Miami is the exact sort of team that like Atlanta is going to struggle with to a certain extent based off of where their strengths are on offense, which is still very Trey centric, and the specifics of Miami's defense and what they're able to do to a guard like Trey Young. And so this is where having Bam being able to play higher within actions
and that agility
and having bigger guards who can get over and through screens and bother Trey in ways that if you neutralize him, then there's a reason why Trey's on-off stats are as good as they are. And there's a reason why Atlanta can be such a tricky matchup night to night during the regular season. But then when you drill down against them, you're able to do more and more things if you do not have to play in a drop. And that's the thing, is Miami does not have to play in a drop. They just don't. They can shock and they can play at the level of the ball. And to a certain extent, I think this is a nice bridge to go into the Minnesota Memphis series, is that that's a series as well where now both teams are playing higher at the level of the ball. And I think it's disrupting the scoring guards that are in that series, especially John Morant. And so maybe on the other half of this, if there's another thought around this series, then we could get to that on the other side of the break. But otherwise, let's shift gears.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
So, Mike, you have ties to Minnesota, and we were texted a fair amount during the Memphis-Minnesota game tonight, which the Grizzlies won. They again came back in the fourth quarter from a double-digit deficit, and won game five. They're now leading 3-2. Just go in whatever direction you want regarding this series, and maybe start with some of the issues that some of the guards are having.
Are you sure you don't want me and Pete to just debate Atlanta for another segment? I did not think, I don't know, I did not expect that was going to happen. It was like, usually we just kind of agree on all these teams. I was like, oh, okay, you like the Hawks a little more than I do. So.
A perfectly solid team, yeah.
They are. They are a perfectly solid team. They got trounced, though, by a very good team.
Yeah, they're perfectly solid 14th, 15th ranked, you know, team in the league. But I digress. Well, I didn't. I actually regret. Okay. So, Minnesota.
No, they're better than Denver and Utah, Mike.
You can... I don't think that's true.
I don't know why actually. Why are we doing this? Why are we even doing this? Let's talk about it.
Oh my God.
We just can't leave it alone. We can't help it.
We can't help it. It's not like embrace debate.
We're both competitive. So, yes. Memphis and Minnesota, Mike.
Just genuine feelings. Not even. Okay. So I'm watching this game, right? So my wife is watching it as a Minnesota fan, right? So like that's where we met. And I've had to, there's been a certain part of me when I watch them every year, I get a little bit further distance, right? And I'm sort of just watching them like they're any team now. Even though in my heart of hearts, sure. Like if it's not the best thing for my life is for the Lakers to win. If we take that aside, then sure, like the Wolves would be that second team, right, that I would be rooting for. But I'm still kind of watching this more in the context of trying to analyze it and like, all right, what are we going to talk about with Darius and Pete on this? And I also think that thanks to doing this podcast with you guys, especially, I'm watching it a little bit more from that kind of like Coach Darius, Coach Pete viewpoint.
I was really getting irritated.
I was really getting irritated with a couple of different things, but the first and most important element of it is like a team finding who they are within the context of that team. And in the playoffs, that matters so much more than in the regular season. Cause you can kind of just get through regular seasons most night based on scouting reports and talent. But you know, the Celtics figured it out earlier this year and Brown had to take somewhat, at least, of a subservient role to Tatum on offense, buy into being more of that support player. And guess what? He still was able to get his because the ball would then get back to him and it just worked better. Like they figured out what that balance was going to be. Smart figured out what the balance was going to be, where he was going to initiate some but not do as much, right? They figured it out and we're seeing the benefit of that.
Yeah.
Well, so for Minnesota, they have not figured it out. And Edwards and Towns and Russell, and to me, the guy that clearly has to take that subservient role, play more off the ball, hit some open shots, sure, attack on the weak side from time to time, but is D'Angelo. And D'Angelo isn't doing that every time, including the one possession that really I think was frustrating probably for Wolves fans to watch was final minute. And D'Lo, with 18 seconds left in the shot clock, brushes Edwards aside, who's the one guy that's been getting to the rim, especially with Jaren Jackson Jr. on the bench, right? And Clark having to come over, and he can't quite impact Edwards. And or Kat, who's not only shooting the ball well, but is making, had just made a couple of good decisions, and he waves him off, goes ISO on Desmond Bane, good defender, and draws help, and still shoots a fadeaway that's like 15 feet, okay, 2 feet off. And so that kind of a little thing. Now, yes, ISO scoring sometimes has to happen, and it's not always the worst thing to have a guy that can go get his, but that just, it sort of shows this break in the chain mentally of how that team should be scoring and when. Maybe I overreacted to it, but I'm curious if you guys noticed that and how much, I think that's been basically, for a team that played really well, you know, it's really tough to have some possessions like that because they deserve to win that game based on how they played overall.
The end of games often comes down to that ISO scoring, but he's not your best ISO scorer on the floor at that moment. And Edwards had created a couple of buckets. And a lot of those shots, Mike, are those over-the-top type shots. Like one of the things I love about Edwards is the elevation that he gets on his jumper. And that's something that in end-of-game situations, D, when everybody's minding their P's and Q's on defense, they're in a stance, they're locked in, they've already played you four times, and they've already guarded you four times, so they know all the moves and your counter moves and all that. You got to be able to get to somewhere that nobody else can access. That's one of the reasons why small guards can have problems, because once everybody's locked in, those passing lanes aren't there that you were talking about. They don't have that access to a go-to move or a something they can do when the defense plays, does exactly what they're supposed to do. A guy like Edwards can do that. A guy like D'Lo doesn't quite have that in his game. A guy like D'Lo doesn't have that against anybody defensively. He could have that against certain matchups, but down the stretch of a game and in that type of possession where it's like, we need to get one shot and one good shot against a set defense, that, speaking to Mike's point, you got to give the ball to your best guy. If you're going to go look to attack and match up hunt one-on-one, the best guy there is clearly Edwards. And I think the fact that there is that kind of like, get out of my way, I'm going to go to work, when you're not that guy, speaks to Mike's point about not having it figured out.
Darius, if I can redirect this to you, that to me just, it also is kind of a theme with that team, right? And that, so yes, in that specific situation, it hurt them, but I think it just also hurts them over the course of the series. And by the way, Pat Bev, same problems. Who, at times, he's been great. He's been the biggest reason why they've changed their culture there defensively. And he should get a lot of credit for that. I would have had him on my All-NBA second team defense. But he also, at times, just gets so excited and so into it that he'll just like foray into the paint, right? In these, we didn't have to, there wasn't a lot of that on that. Like, for example, when the Lakers were winning those playoff games, usually it was, with an exception here or there, it was controlled by LeBron. And then when AD had it, it was in the spots where you wanted him to attack. And I feel like that's got to be something for a team to make a real run that has to be crystallized.
So the Wolves have blown two double-digit leads in fourth quarters. It's going to be very difficult to win a playoff series if you have to win six games.
Yes.
Seriously.
No. Yeah.
Right? Because in theory, the Wolves should have already won this series. They have two wins already. Memphis has three. They gave up a 21-0 run in game three and lost that game. They were up, I think, 13 or 15 points going into the fourth quarter. They had a 10-point lead, I think, with 10 minutes left. And so everything that you're saying about D'Angelo Russell is correct. I thought his general decision-making this game was pretty bad. Even going back to the early parts of the game where he was penetrating but kicking with no advantage and throwing it into passing lanes where there were arms and all kinds of stuff. I also thought that Karl-Anthony Towns, for all of his numbers, and I thought that he hit a huge three and Anthony Edwards hit a huge three as well. I thought that Cat was just like, I got Dylan Brooks on me, but you don't see me basically just shoving this dude down to the paint in order to get a post touch. Anthony Edwards they were running ball screens between him and D'Lo in order to get Ja Morant on him. You didn't see Edwards basically just put his head down and get to the basket and try to get a bucket. No, he took long jumper after long, long jumper. The one time he did try to drive, he still pulled up. He got an offensive rebound and then he short-armed the putback. Right. So what I saw from Minnesota was a bunch of dudes not making the right decisions on any play. I saw a young team that didn't know how to win a basketball game. And then I saw Pat Bev foul out and make several like suspect plays as well. Like, oh, well, no one else is doing anything. Let me drive and try to score on a dude. And then Mike, I look at the assist numbers. D'Angelo Russell had 8 assists, so he led the team. So even within the context of like all of the poor decision making, you know how many assists Anthony Edwards had? He had zero assists, and Karl-Anthony Towns had one. Right, and so when you're talking about the usage of who your playmakers are going to be, at least Russell is trying to create some action for guys at times as well, even though his decision making, he does need to pull back, especially in the shot pass decisions. And so there's a lot going on here.
On his terms is all.
Yes.
But you're right. So he did make more of the plays, but it's a little bit like when Westbrook has a lot of the assists. It's like, well, yeah, but like I want the basketball and, you know.
And so I look at the Wolves and I see a team that isn't ready yet. Now, they're hanging tight in these games because they got athletes and they're giving Ja fits at the point of attack. And Jaren Jackson Jr. has like suddenly regressed in a playoff series where he looks like first or second year dude who cannot stop fouling and has no confidence in what his own offensive shot creation is going to look like. And that's why they're hanging tight in this series. And that's why it's 3-2. right? But I see a couple of young teams that Memphis has one leg up in terms of the race, in terms of we know what the hell that we're doing. And that one leg up has gotten them one more win. But it's like a good series without it being high quality basketball yet, but it's a good fun series.
All right, let's take another break. When we come back, the final game of the night, Phoenix and the Pelicans.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So yesterday's pod was question like a bit of an like, are the Suns suddenly in jeopardy? And D, we didn't get to hear your thoughts on the Suns in that pod. And so I'd love to hear. I saw a game tonight where, as a smaller team, that it was the best example of how you can win as being a smaller team, while also making some adjustments. We saw a little JaVale and DeAndre Ayton playing at the same time to match the two big lineups of the Pelicans. And there were little adjustments within that, but I thought the Suns were quicker to the spot.
Yeah.
And they executed, especially in the places where you need. The way you take down bigger players is you swarm them. And I thought that their ability to swarm and sandwich rebound and just that they were the best example of how to win that way. Mikal Bridges was tremendous. And then obviously they do have a big guy in DeAndre Ayton who's got, you know, great shot making ability, or, you know, in a bunch of different spots. Talk to me a bit about what you saw from a Phoenix Suns win where they kept the Pelicans at an arm's distance for most of the night.
Yeah, I just think that this is the version of the Suns that can definitely win this series, and maybe even as early as the next game. That when you don't have all of your dudes, the thing that stood out in game four and was in contrast to this game is how off track the Pelicans were able to get the Suns in terms of what their execution is, right? And Monty Williams, if there's one thing that you've had to appreciate about the Suns in their turnaround under Monty and with Chris Paul, is that their general execution level went from, I don't know, like a 25 or a 30 on any given night before Chris Paul and Monty got there to like in between 85 and 95.
Yeah.
Almost every night.
Yeah.
Right. And so to see some of these games where it's just like, oh, look at this. You're at 60 now. Like, where'd that come from? Because we haven't seen a lot of that this year from the Suns. But this was another night, I thought, where their execution went up a level and their attention to detail went up like two or three notches from where it's been at various points this series. And so that crispness and sharpness, I think, got the Pelicans on their heels, where in a battle of like skill and tactics versus like strength and physical advantages, the skill and tactics won out. And then they still had enough physicality with a guy like Ayton and then JaVale and in his own way, Bridges, and that swarming mentality that, well, that you discussed, Pete. I thought all of that stuff combined to basically say like, no, we're the superior team. And that's what I saw in this game. And we'll see if that carries over to game six when they're not at home and the crowd isn't booing Alvarado every single time he actually just like steps within 3 feet of Chris Paul, right? And so I think there are adjustments, though, that New Orleans can now make and sort of say, okay, well, this is how we've got to get the game back.
Yes, we did spend some time last pod without you in it, so it's good to get your perspective here on it, because I think that tonight's game, the typical game five at home is the rally around the flag, home crowd, desperation mode. You know, this is the one that we have to have. And it's very difficult for the road team to win that, even when the talent is really close. And which is why, despite all we just said about Minnesota, it was impressive that they were in that game to that extent, you know, that they somehow found a way to hang around. Now, I also think, though, that speaks some to Memphis's inexperience as well. But to focus on this series specifically, so the final score ends up being 112-97, and Phoenix had it in, you know, pretty good control. But I think that New Orleans able to kind of hang and battle, even when they weren't, it was not their A game. They did not play particularly well. You know, Ingram was 7-for-19. I think he's had to carry such a load that he was a little bit fatigued. They were trapping him more aggressively.
Yeah.
In this part, Pete, trying to get the ball out of his hands. I mean, and then who else was going to? CJ was 7-for-22, right? 1-for-8 from three. And so I think that New Orleans put so much into their game four specifically to get that win. And it was such a high for them that then they had to come down. And even with all the stuff that happened with Chris Paul. So this was one of those, like, it would have been hard for me to see New Orleans, even if they had the same energy, getting that win. But I now think that it flips back to, because I think they're close enough talent wise that I think that New Orleans can win game six. And then I would go back to picking Phoenix in game seven. But Pete had me going on telling the story about the Orlando Magic series in 2009.
And
before they got to the finals, it made me think back to Houston, that series where Lakers were clearly the better team, but Houston had some guys and they had some matchups and it was just kind of a weird team. And so on a given night, like when the Lakers really focused on them in game five is the best example, completely smashed them, right? That home game five, 118-78. They just took them apart. Then they went to Houston and lost game six by 15, 95-80. And so what happens in game seven? They come out right from the jump and take care of business again. They win by 19 points, like 89. So it wasn't like the series was ever really in doubt. But and I don't think the gap now with Devin Booker out is as big as that in this series. Like, I think New Orleans is actually the team that, as they showed in keeping game five somewhat competitive, I think that showed a lot about them, Pete, and it makes me eager to see what happens in game six.
Yeah, if I could jump on that Houston analogy, that was a Yao team. And one of the reasons that was an unusual team is because Yao was 7'6". And talk about an over-the-top advantage. Remember that beautiful jump shot he had? I wish his career was longer. He was a really good player. And but Yao was
great guy, too. Great. Something people don't know about Yao, one of the most fun guys to talk to in the entire NBA, would give anybody time. He would just sit back in his locker, grin on his face, really like a sweet guy, insightful. That'll be another time. Maybe we'll get to Yao story time, but Yao is one of my favorites.
I would love that. I did not know that. And as a player, there wasn't really anybody else in the league like him he was a 7'6" guy with touch. And so B.I. Had a rough night in the second half, especially where he got to his spots and got his shots and it just wasn't really falling. He had a fall to the ground. He went up, you know, attacked the basket, got fouled and landed like right on his tailbone and was kind of struggling after that. And so that combined with McCollum had a rough second half as well. I think there's a lot to that point, Mike, about they lost some gas at the end of that game. But it was also, to your point, D, that they were a step ahead, Phoenix was, I thought, for much of the night, and really kind of – I think they win game six just because – they started doing things, for example, the blitzing BI, that's going to play into the weaker parts of BI's game, especially when these are reads not coming off of pick and rolls, where he's gotten really good on that read, but kind of those like, oh, we're going to trap you 30 feet from the basket and we're going to, you know, take away all your strong side passes, and you're going to have to make that skip pass over the top to the weak side corner, right? And just kind of like mixing things up, I think is going to be tough for the Pelicans going forward. And then if they're on minding their P's and Q's on the defensive boards with, you know, sandwich rebounding, put a body on them down low, they limited more of that in this game. They rebounded more effectively than in previous games. I think that they've kind of found the formula even without Booker. They needed a good game from Campaign. It was his best game of the series. And they'll have that momentum. And I agree with Mike that dynamic certainly shifts, but what I saw was of that question, are the Suns in trouble? After watching that performance, I don't think they are.
I'll be interested to see what kind of adjustments Willie Green makes, particularly from a substitution standpoint. He's obviously been putting a lot of length and size on Chris Paul, and that's worked at times. But putting a player as big as Herb Jones on him also makes that screen a little bit easier to set because it's just a bigger target to set the screen on. And so Chris is going to use a screen regardless of who's defending him, and then he's going to snake it regardless, right?
And Herb also didn't have a lot left on the other end, right? Like because of him guarding Chris Paul so serious, he was 1-for-5.
Yeah. No,
that's right. And so I'll be interested to see how much more Alvarado can play and if he can pick up Chris Paul 94 feet, like, I don't know, for 75% of the possessions that they're on the floor together. Because I think this series, the Suns are, I think 1-5, the Suns have certain advantages in terms of like who can actually score and do more on the court. I really like Ayton, and I really like Bridges, and I really like Johnson.
Yeah.
And so those are guys that I think have just a little bit more shot creation than they're giving credit for. And then, but they really do depend on Chris Paul and the system in order to put them in advantageous positions. And so the thing I'll be interested in seeing is, can you put Chris Paul in positions where he's working so much harder? And in theory, putting Herb Jones on him does that, in theory, with the size and the length and the obstruction of view. But Alvarado is a pest. He is an irritant. And you know how they talk about like, oh, you bully a bully, right? Like, oh, a bully comes to bully you, you punch him in the mouth. Well, there's no bigger irritant than Chris Paul. And so I think that same theory applies. Like, oh, you want to. Yeah. No, exactly. No, you get one of those other dudes, right? And so there's no wonder that, like, who's Chris Paul's biggest feud, like, in the league is probably, what, like, Rondo, right? So that's another dude that's just like, oh, I'm just going to irritate the shit out of you,
right?
Like, I'm just going to be all very up similar, in there, at, like, that same personality. And so I'll be interested to see if there are changes that sort of switch up, because you would think putting a smaller dude on Chris Paul might make his life easier, but not if he has to face ball pressure every single possession. And then, because what the Suns are doing then is just like, okay, well, you, like, someone else bring the ball up. And then do they have to play two guards more, or give the ball to Shamit more, or give the ball to Cam Johnson more and Mikal Bridges more, and say you initiate the offense or bring it up and then give it to Chris? Because then that can throw off the rhythm of their offense too. So I think there's more adjustments to be made, Pete. I don't know if it leads to a win in game 6 for New Orleans, but there's other cards to play here that I'm interested to see if they do get played.
I like it.
Let me ask a box score question to Pete for a second here, because I think that if you just look at sometimes the players, the first thing they'll do after the game, they'll look at the physical box score, and there are a couple things on there. They'll jump out, and then the coach will speak, you know, and then the next day they'll go into film and they'll really iron in, and then they'll watch their individual film with an assistant coach next to them a lot of times.
Uh-huh.
But so the first thing here, right? So Ingram 7-for-19, McCollum 7-for-22. And then Bridges 12-for-17, In campaign, he ended up missing a lot of shots late, but was 4-for-10 and like actually gave them some pop off the bench, which they hadn't had. So New Orleans can get on that plane and be like, oh, come on, man, we'll get back to game six. Like, that's not happening again. BI's not going 7-for-19. CJ's definitely not going 7-for-22. And Bridges damn sure isn't going 4-for-4 from three, right, in 12-for-17 overall. So like Chris Paul was good, you know, 8-for-18. Ayton was good, pretty typical for him, 8-for-13. But so those are, Pete, what did you see in terms of how they were getting their shots? And like, do you think that that part is going to flip, and then that would give New Orleans, at least for game six, a better chance? Again, I'm still picking Phoenix to win the series.
Yeah, so it was the defensive adjustments from Phoenix that were more, this is going to be difficult for New Orleans to navigate this. And like, Darius, I thought, made a good argument for some of the remaining cards to play. I'm not as confident in them, but he moved me a little bit away from that for sure. But yeah, the trapping BI in particular, and then their approach to the boards, I think that their defense from this game is sustainable. The Bridges going 4-for-4 from three is not, but I think that what I started seeing in that series that begged that question is, are they in trouble? Was like, oh, Phoenix isn't able to get stops on these guys when they want to get stops on them. Yeah, you know what I mean? And so like, I think that Phoenix has enough offensively to, I don't know if it's going to be Bridges one night or if maybe it's CP3 that goes 12-for-18 the next game instead. But I just thought that Phoenix's defensive adjustments were like, okay, you made things difficult when you wanted to make things difficult. When I see a team of their caliber like lock in the last couple minutes of a close game and they can't like stop a guy like BI, or they can't stop CJ, or they're just getting good look after good look, I'm like, uh-oh. So I just saw that being shored up a little bit.
I also thought too, just one last thing, Phoenix's transition defense was so much better. Oh, I think New Orleans had like four fast break points or something like that. And so Phoenix is never going to be like a super fast team, especially without Booker. Like, he's a guy that can race the floor a little bit more. And Chris Paul teams have never really played fast. But them getting stops allows them to play at the proper pace and tempo without having to walk the ball up after a made basket, right? Or after dealing with like seven offensive rebounds on like a single possession, the way that New Orleans was getting, which basically drags you back and makes you play even slower and at the tempo that New Orleans wants because you're not sending anyone out, right? And so there's stuff like that have definitely, that has shifted more towards Phoenix. And if it stays that way, like, New Orleans is going to have trouble scoring still, like, because they need those open court chances. They need the Suns in a scramble situation to create the open threes for all of their shooters, right? And not allow CJ to like basically be draped all over by like a bigger wing like Bridges, and for Crowder to be able to hold on Ingram and just rough him up, right? And so there's stuff that New Orleans needs to go their way a little bit more. And like you, Pete, like, I do question if that is going to go all of the way in their direction, but there are things that they can do to try to facilitate that stuff.
Part of the fun of a 7-game series. I'm certainly loving us bouncing around the league like this. All right, we'll be back tomorrow with more. But until then, you've been listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Ainge has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic, got it. Magic fires. It's in. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game.
Rebound to Lottie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel the winner. It's on the way.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston. Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal! Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two, one.
Miss it!
Bryant,
yeah.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis, 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good! Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers! James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.